Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Simon Williams. I'm chair and professor in the Department of Dramatic Art here at UC Santa Barbara, and I'd like to wish you all a very warm welcome to Santa Barbara, and I hope that some of you will in fact come and visit our department. When you go to the faculty club, you'll actually go past the department, which is now, today I understand, has just been knocked down because we're having a new building. But you will see our theater and then a completely vacated space where a new building is going to be going. It's my privilege to be moderating this panel today on the science play Today and in History, and I would just like to very briefly introduce the five speakers. Christopher Innes from the Department of English at York University in Toronto, and then next door to him is Harry Lustig, who is a professor emeritus at CUNY in the Graduate Center in physics, and then next door to him is Sidney Perkovitz, who is also a professor of physics at Emory University, and then next door to him is Toby Zinman, who is in the Department of English at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia, and finally, last but not least at the end, is Brian Schwartz, who also teaches at the CUNY Graduate Center in physics. I've asked everyone to give fairly brief presentations. This is only going to be about an hour, but I hope that in fact the presentations will be short enough that will allow for a sort of a good question and answer session in the latter part of this session. And I'm first going to ask Toby Zinman to speak. After that, the order will be Sidney Perkovitz, Harry Lustig, Christopher Innes, and then finally Brian Schwartz. And I would like to ask everybody to keep their questions until everybody has given their presentation. And one other thing I've been asked to request is that you don't speak, or at least you can indicate you want to speak, but you don't actually speak until somebody hands you a microphone so that it can be recorded. And so without any further ado, I would like to invite Toby to begin the panel.
Thank you. This is called Staging Eureka. W. H. Auden said, "When I find myself in the company of scientists, I feel like a shabby curate who has strayed by mistake into a room full of dukes." Now I know what he meant. I begin with the trivium and quadrivium, the medieval idea of education, the seven liberal arts, the seven pillars of wisdom. The trivium includes grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic, the sciences of language, considered the more elementary group, named for the junction of three roads, a crossroads open to all. The quadrivium includes arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, with the mathematical branches considered intermediate and the scientific branches the highest level of study. The Platonic notion on which all this is based assumes that one should proceed from sense perception to intellectual argumentation to finally intellectual intuition. It is this intuition that is the subject, if not alas the impetus, of my paper, complicated by an English professor, trivial, speaking not only about science, but about the science musical, doubly quadrivial. Andrew Wiles, the Princeton mathematician who proved Fermat's last theorem, said that when he found the solution, not to the theorem, but to the whole in his first proof, quote, "Suddenly, totally unexpectedly, I had this incredible revelation. It was the most important moment of my working life. It was so indescribably beautiful. It was so simple, so elegant." It is this staging of the scientific epiphany, the theatricalizing, of this mysterious moment when the mind, working at its highest level, does that thrillingly human thing, getting it. This eureka moment is the subject of two little-known musical comedies, Fermat's Last Tango and Schrodinger's Girlfriend, and it is the subject of this paper. In her novel, The Properties of Light, Rebecca Goldstein, this actually, we just heard a little piece of this, has Samuel Mollock, her broken half-mad physicist, talk about Schrodinger. "The entire structure of wave mechanics all poured out from a secret tryst of Schrodinger's. He had many known lovers, but the identity of this particular woman has never been learned. He went off with her over the Christmas holidays of 1925. By January, he had sent a major paper, Three more followed. It was, Mollock continues, a period of sustained creative activity without a parallel in the history of science. And he did it all by himself, like Einstein and relativity, without any collaborators, with the sole exception of whoever that unknown woman was. End quote. A couple of years earlier, Matthew Wells took this piece of physics gossip as the basis of his musical comedy, Schrödinger's Girlfriend. Hansi Haas, a cabaret singer, very noirish, very sexy, has the brains of Madame Curie and the body of Mata Hari. We and Schrödinger discover that in the course of the show, she is also the mistress of Einstein, Planck, Bohr, de Broglie, Heisenberg, Michelson and Morley, as well as twins named Varner and Werner. Tom Stoppard has used this last device, twins anthropomorphizing the duality of light, to excellent effect in Hapgood, in which a second set of twins becomes the solution to the Hapgood plot. In Stoppard's play, a Russian physicist, a specialist in the nature of light, is a double agent. In the duplicitous world of espionage, in the duplicitous world of theater, and in the duplicitous world of quantum physics, twinning is crucial. It seems to me that the real challenge in staging quantum physics lies with the lighting designer, but that's another paper. Hansi is the muse of 20th century physics, the agent of Eureka, whose skirt must be lifted to lift the veil. Sex with Hansi allows these legendary physicists to emerge from her bedroom with their next big idea. De Broglie tells Schrödinger in a French-German spat, quote, a scientific discovery such as I have made is like an endless night of slow, sweet love with the most beautiful woman in the world. Next to that, an equation is like kissing the mustache of your monkey-faced bag of a wife. End quote. One is reminded of Feynman's famous comment, physics is to mathematics what sex is to masturbation. The clever conceit of Schrödinger's Girlfriend makes the stage double as Schrödinger's box. It is this double doubling, and this is a double doubling, since stages always double as the world they represent. Like the whimsical story by Ursula Le Guin, Schrödinger's cat, which seems to take place entirely on a subatomic level, and which advises us to use larger boxes, Schrödinger's Girlfriend takes place both inside and outside the box, in both the theoretical and the human realms. The theories of quantum physics being played and being played with, superposition, complementarity, uncertainty, all address the paradox of two contradictory truths, just as theater does. The act of observing, the crucial role of the audience, changes that which is observed. The show's casting reveals duality, as of course any casting does, since the person on stage is both himself and his character. But here the dualities are multiple. De Broglie, Michelson, Einstein, Bohr, and Varner are played by one actor. Morley, Heisenberg, Planck, and Werner are played by another actor. Schrödinger's wife, who sets up the historic meeting between her husband and Hansi, is played by the same actor who plays Lulu, Hansi's sidekick, who manages her affairs. As Mrs. Schrödinger says, you should write a paper about how wave-particle duality is like wife-lover duality. Hansi and Lulu do a cabaret act called the Double Slut Patter, during which they appear and reappear through two onstage doors, which double as the doors to Hansi's bedroom, accompanied by Michelson and Morley. The wife-lover, actor-character, world-stage dualities proliferate in this observer-created reality. Schrödinger's box is doubled not only by the stage arena, but by Hansi's nightclub in Vienna, called Die Büchse der Pandora. As Hansi says, quote, as long as they keep waiting, I will always be on my way, which is to say that the next big breakthrough is always just about to happen, which seems to be another way of expressing hope, that which remains in Pandora's box after all the ills of the world fly out. Hansi theorizes, quote, if the only thing that stands between us and emptiness is probability, then that means the odds are on our side. The odds favor life. Without us, nothing matters. The pun of that last word is both ravishing and hilarious, especially since the whole point of puns is that light, they have a dual nature. Fermat's Last Tango, a charming and entertaining musical comedy by Joshua Rosenblum and Joanne Sidney Lessner, takes as its subject the mathematical Eureka. The show begins just after the event in 1993, when Andrew Wiles, here called Daniel King, meets the press and explains that he has, after 350 years, solved Fermat's last theorem. The exposition is aided by the device of having one of the reporters, who usually writes the Sunday feature, filling in for the science guy who has the flu. Just as Keane's long-suffering wife is rejoicing in having him back, he worked on the proof for 7 years. Fermat appears to him, flamboyantly dressed in 17th century white satin and plumed hat. He escorts Keane to a place called the Aftermath to meet Pythagoras, Euclid, Newton, and Gauss. The mathematicians sing a wonderful fugue about symmetry, which disintegrates quickly into rivalry. Gauss, the great math meister, complaining that he is always ignored. Euclid singing, geometry, geometry, hello, hello, remember me? Once in their august company, Fermat informs them all that Keane's proof has a flaw, and Keane is devastated. Since Fermat's claim to immortal fame is his last theorem, he is eager to keep Keane from solving it. What we are really witnessing is Keane's horrifying realization, a eureka in reverse. Eventually, fed up with Fermat's arrogance, the Fab Four decide to help Keane. They have to study up on the math, since what they need is new to them, and in doing so, they feel the old thrill and sing, once again our passion stirs, long left in hibernation, and drop into his mind the clue. Within your failures lie the seeds of your success. Significantly, they don't solve it for him. They merely plant a seed, which I take to mean hope, belief in intellectual stamina. Any real clue would be unintelligible to the audience anyway, since staging the requirements of an Euler system would be ridiculous. Much later, his wife will comfort him by singing, "It's often said within your failures lie the seeds of your success." And suddenly he realizes, intuits, leaps into his solution, making the horizontal Iwasawa theory work. When he finds the solution, it is, quote, as simple and as elegant as the great mathematicians have required, and he is promised a place in the aftermath as the score's love song, The Beauty of Numbers, is reprised. His theorem, his career, his marriage, and the show are resolved simultaneously. It is worth knowing that both shows follow the grand old tradition of musical comedy. Love conquers all, and men and women work together to triumph over adversity. Fermat's Last Tango brings a first-tier mathematician into the human fold, makes him accessible and sympathetic, makes a non-mathematical audience care about solving the theorem without compromising the mathematics, as, say, the play Proof does, whose mathematicians could as well be any dysfunctional American family, a script which makes us root for the oppressed woman and for the love story and not for the proof. Auburn's play blunders in ways large and small, the large being that a play called Proof depends on trust. And in small, when Auburn invents the pivotal detail that the professor believed that he was being sent messages via library books using the Dewey Decimal System, when the University of Chicago, the play's locale, uses, as great all university libraries do, the Library of Congress system. But I digress. A Philadelphia newspaper interviewer suggested to Andrew Wiles that at his exalted level, mathematics approaches art, that Wiles is closer to a composer than an accountant. He replied, "It's certainly very creative, but there's one problem with the analogy. Mathematicians feel they're discovering things that are already there. I'm not sure a composer would think that. Whereas with the things we're discovering, the theorems themselves, we feel we've discovered what nature has known all along." Much of my pleasure in science theater is watching that creative leap into the next revelation, giving me the very satisfying, if lesser, thrill of getting there, getting it, raising the curtain on raising the veil.
Harry, I believe you're second. Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon, Sydney. Yeah.
It's a hard act to follow.
Yeah. Thank you.
I want to tell everyone I'm breaking with physics tradition entirely by reading something rather than just showing you overhead, so this is quite new for me. Part of what I'll read today is based on a paper written jointly with Lauren Gunderson, who will be presenting at a later panel of this conference. And finally, let me ask your indulgence. I have a bit of a cold. My voice is not what it should be, but I'll do my best. Science, theater, and interdisciplinary energy. The new rush of science plays gives possibilities for collaboration that advance both science and drama, and for novel ways to communicate science. But the combination also brings special issues. I'll discuss these questions and then present an example of one of my plays as both drama and teaching tool at Emory University. To begin, I first offer this definition. A science play is one in which scientists and scientific ideas, ethical issues, or interactions with society are important elements. Like any other well-done play, a science play must offer strong dramatic structure and meaningful character development. It must also tell the story of a scientist and his or her science, but without leaving the audience feeling that it has attended a lecture rather than a play. While the scientists want to see science accurately presented, the playwright is concerned with emotional power. Given these constraints, you might be surprised at the number and variety of existing science plays. Some recent compilations, one of them done by my fellow panelist here, Harry Lustig, some recent compilations list over 80 plays with scientific or pre-scientific themes. A primary issue for any such play is to determine the level and amount of science that is included. This raises specific questions for playwrights, such as, are science plays really about science? What happens if a play is about science, but without scientists as characters, like John Barrow's Infinities? What happens if a play is about scientists, but not about science? How much simplification of the science and fictionalization of the characters is acceptable? The answers to these questions lie partly in the playwright's intentions. The playwright may want to educate the audience about science, as strongly championed by the scientist playwright Carl Gerassi. Alternatively, the science may appear almost incidentally, like the play Approved, which could be about any dysfunctional family. Or the dramatist may use a scientific idea only to give a metaphorical structure to the play. The playgoer's receptivity to scientific issues also matters. A well-crafted science play such as Copenhagen can be a crowd pleaser, but what works for the dramatist and the theatergoers might not work for the scientists, who may find it hard to accept changes the playwright makes for dramatic reasons. Simplification of the science can be seen as distortion. Nevertheless, fruitful collaboration can happen as long as there's mutual respect between scientists and theater people. The collaboration can occur within a single person or may indeed involve separate scientists and dramatists. Both approaches have produced gripping and scientifically valid plays. But a belief in the value of integration does not automatically tell the playwright how to incorporate science into a play. The answers are as varied as dramatists themselves. For myself, trained as a physicist, one reason I write popular science books and plays is that I think it essential to present science to the public. I want my plays to move audiences, but I also want playgoers to leave the theater with deeper understanding of a scientific idea or of the motivations that turn people into scientists, or best of all, both. In my play, Friedman's Balloon, the ideas are Einstein's general relativity and the expanding universe. In my dance performance piece, Albert and Isadora, that's Albert Einstein and Isadora Duncan meeting each other and having a flirtation, the idea is the behavior of time within special relativity. And in my play, Glory Enough, the ideas are the importance of DNA and the power of X-ray analysis. Surprisingly, sometimes it's easier to present ideas in a play than in nonfiction prose. Prose is typically written in the single voice of the author, whereas drama opens up possibilities for lucid and engaging exposition through the power of dialogue. But I try not to set the bar higher than is useful to the theater goer. I focus on concepts, not details, and use metaphors to penetrate abstract scientific ideas. My aim is not to give a lecture, but to incorporate science into the drama to give the theater goer new ideas to contemplate. As an example, I'll talk about my latest play, Glory Enough, as both dramatic presentation and teaching tool. This one-act play presented at my university by Theatre Emory this past month is a dramatized story of the young English scientist Rosalind Franklin. In the early 1950s, Franklin greatly contributed to the discovery of the structure of DNA. However, her role was, by most accounts, suppressed during her lifetime, while Jim Watson, Francis Crick, and Morris Wilkins went on to win the Nobel Prize for the discovery. In addition, Watson's book, The Double Helix, presented Franklin and her work in an unflattering light. We had a discussion this morning about heroes in science. For those who are worried writing about science makes scientists too heroic, have no fear. My play will show you otherwise. Franklin is an inherently dramatic character, a woman who wanted to be a scientist from an early age, who worked hard to do superb X-ray work, but whose efforts went unrecognized, and who died at age 37 of cancer, perhaps caused by the very X-rays she used. To me, first and foremost, the play is about injustice, and that drove my writing to a large extent. But I also wanted to tell the audience exactly what Franklin had been deprived of, which meant describing her science. For that reason, Franklin and her friend Anne in the play have a dialogue that tells the audience about X-rays and how Franklin used them to study DNA. The play also included a screen projection of Franklin's famous photo 51, her X-ray image that was a final step in Watson and Crick's determination that DNA contains a double helix. The two presentations of Glory Enough attracted many undergraduates as well as faculty and off-campus playgoers. Each show was followed by a Q&A session with me as the playwright, visiting scholar Lynn Elkin, who's writing the book about Rosalind Franklin, and the cast and director. The following day, we held a more formal panel discussion under the title Scientific Ethics, Proper Credit, and Gender, the Case of Rosalind Franklin and DNA, which involved Professor Elkin as well as a science historian and a biologist with me as moderator. These linked events exposed over 100 of Emory's science majors, mostly women, to an important story about science and how it's done, and about how women were and are treated in science. Our discussions included references to Harvard President Lawrence Summers' now famous words about women in science, and so were unexpectedly topical. For me, what was especially important was one student comment that illuminated what a play can uniquely accomplish. Although this student had read the standard works about the DNA, research and Franklin's role in it, she told me that the compressed and heightened format of Glory Enough finally clarified for her all the issues, scientific, ethical, and personal. If science plays present special challenges, they also offer special rewards. They give the opportunity to combine compelling human stories with compelling ideas, or for the satisfaction of making science and scientists more understandable to the rest of the world, and provide a powerful interdisciplinary teaching tool. As a physicist, it's important to me that the science in a science play be presented correctly, but that doesn't mean in a detailed or highly technical way. As a playwright, it's equally important to me that the science be in proper balance with the human story, for that's the only way people will come to see my science plays or anyone else's. Thank you.
Thank you,
Frank.
Thank you very much, and thank the organizers for inviting me to this fascinating conference. This being a conference which deals mainly with fiction, I probably should get a minor fiction in the introduction go unnoticed, but I can't. I'm not a professor emeritus at the Graduate Center of CUNY. I'm professor emeritus of physics at the City College of New York. Also, and one other correction, the list of 80 science plays that Sid referred to was actually started by Kirsten Shepherd Barr and me for an article we wrote in The American Scientist about science and theater. And just recently, Brian added some 30 more plays to the 80 that were already there, so that's great. I'm afraid of one of the people that Alan Lightman referred to who look for a topic sentence. And at least for a title, and the title was about science plays in history. So I thought I'd do a little small paper on science plays in history. I'm not going to go back to Thomas Shadwell, or much less Aristophanes. But I will, with the aid of a few examples, just examine one question. How well do science plays deal with real people, and that deal with real people and actually events respect the facts? Many playwrights will consider this question uninteresting, if not perverse. For therefore, to those, anything goes in fiction. Historians are more likely to favor authenticity unless they have an agenda to sell, which they often do. Scientists on the whole are more critical of distortions of the truth, in particular when in advancing age, rather than fade away, they turn to the history of science, like I have done. In deference to the fact that the conference is sponsored by the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics, I will take all my examples from physics. Bertolt Brecht's Life of Galileo is the first science drama that deals with real persons and events. It addresses significant issues: the responsibility of the scientist to society, the importance of the scientific enterprise, and science and scientists in relation to the authority of church and state. Though Brecht's play is set in the 17th century, his Galileo is a modern scientist, and Brecht frames the conflict in the play in a way that evokes contemporary issues. There are three distinct versions of the play, written between 1938 and 1956. The changes corresponding to the evolution of Brecht's politics, as well as to the unfolding events in the world. Perhaps the most important event was the use of the atomic bomb and the roles of scientists in its development. Brecht noting that, quote, with Hiroshima, overnight the biography of the founder of the new system of physics reads differently. I find, as a physicist, I find this exercise in time reversal problematical. From science and its practices, initially celebrated as a great good, and the failure to stand up for it denounced as cowardice and worse, Brecht came to see a failure in science to consider the interests of humanity as a fatal flaw. In the revised version, science for science's sake becomes the worst outcome Galileo can imagine, bringing with it little more than the potential to be abused by the authorities. Heiner Kipphartz, in The Matter of J. Robert Oppenheimer, first staged in 1964, is one of the more important plays dealing with science. In contrast to the approach of many of the earlier plays portraying scientists, in The Matter of J. Robert Oppenheimer is a quasi-documentary. Almost all of the text is taken verbatim from the transcript of the 1954 hearing that was convened by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission to review Oppenheimer's security clearance. Kipper does allow himself certain liberties, including cutting a great deal of material, reducing the number of witnesses, and occasionally shifting who said what. But the most notable, in fact the only significant violation of the play's documentary character, are the closing remarks that Kipphartz has Oppenheimer make. The speech is a summing up and considers the role of the scientist in modern society, much like Galileo does in Brecht's play. Clearly, Kipphartz did not feel that Oppenheimer said what needed to be said, so he put his own words into Oppenheimer's mouth instead. Now let me take on an important and serious, if flawed, play, the Louis Slotin Sonata by Paul Molland. I do that because, regrettably, it's little known. The play depicts a real event. On May 21, 1946, Louis Slotin, a Canadian physicist at Los Alamos, repeated a criticality test that he had done many times, perhaps too many times, before. He slipped the pieces of a plutonium bomb closer together and farther apart, flirting, as Dennis Overby, who I think is here, wrote in a review in the New York Times, with the moment when the assembly would be on the verge of achieving critical mass. The two plutonium hemispheres were encased in thin shells of beryllium to serve as the neutron reflector. Wooden spaces between the two halves of the shell normally kept it from closing all the way and bringing on criticality. On this occasion, Slotin had removed the spaces and was using the blade of a screwdriver to keep the halves separated. This time, Slotin's screwdriver slipped and the assembly clicked together. Slotin pulled the bomb apart, but it was too late. In the millisecond after the blade had slipped and the shell was closed, he received 2,100 rems of radiation, more than three times the lethal dose. Smaller doses were absorbed by the seven men who were standing behind Slotin and thus were partially shielded by him. They survived and most lived long, healthy lives. Louis Slotin died after 9 days of increasing agony at the Los Alamos Hospital. The playwright uses Slotin's death and his journey to the grave to examine and pronounce on troubling questions of personal behavior and national policy. The device for doing that is the pretense that Slotin, in the days before his death, suffered hallucinations. This allows Mullen to bring on real people and one imaginary character in didactic sequences, somewhat reminiscent of Brecht. J. Robert Oppenheimer is there, repeating his line from the Bhagavad Gita, "I am become death, shatterer of worlds." Einstein appears, yes, playing dice, and God himself shows up, dressed in a period pinstripe suit and a fedora, the very image of Harry S. Truman, the American president, who made the decision to drop the two atomic bombs on Japan. But so also does Josef Mengele, the sadistic Nazi camp doctor, who in one of the dream sequences arrives in Hiroshima to watch, and I quote his line, "What took us years to do in stinking, filth-filled camps, performed in milliseconds." The purpose is, of course, to compare Mengele's experiments to the Los Alamos scientists' work on the bomb, and use it as, and its use as a weapon of mass destruction. The trouble, as the theater critic Bruce Weber pointed out, is that the argument is rendered thinly in the show-offy manner. Quote, "It feels motivated more by theatricality than drama, especially when Mengele leads the show's weirdest sequence, a parody of a vaudeville chorus line with scientists singing doggerel about thermodynamics. Like a lot of the elements in the play, the scene is ornamental and distracting, presented by the playwright not because he should, but because he can. In stage terms, this is playing dice with the universe." As the prominence given to Michael Frayn's Copenhagen in this conference demonstrates, most scientists and many historians, dramatists, and critics consider it the preeminent science play of our generation. It has also been a smashing success with the public. This came as something of a surprise. As the New York Times drama critic Ben Brantley asked in his unreservedly enthusiastic review, who would have ever thought that three dead, long-winded people talking about atomic physics would be such electrifying companions? My time is too short, and the play is undoubtedly so well known to most of you that a synopsis is neither possible nor necessary. Its first great virtue is, as the historian dramatist Robert Mark Friedman has pointed out, that it has clearly brought significant chapters in the history of modern physics to the attention of many non-physicists, non-specialists. An even greater achievement, in my view, is that the play is genuinely, unapologetically, and accurately rendered. This is by no means the case in historical or contemporary science plays always. Even the redoubtable Tom Stoppard makes an error about quantum mechanics in his play Hapgood. And furthermore, for the 1994 New York production, the science was heavily cut and presented in a grossly simplified manner. Frayn delivers mini courses in quantum mechanics and in nuclear physics, which include admirable expositions and explanations of the uncertainty principle and of complementarity, as well as of nuclear fission and its applications. The final extraordinary achievement, although some critics have not seen it that way, is that he deals with still controversial historical facts and the behavior of Werner Heisenberg in a unique, undogmatic way. As the historian of science Klaus Henschel has pointed out, Frayn's use of, quote, historical polyphony, unquote, does not do violence to the rarely attained goal of historical truthfulness. Instead of advocating one among a multitude of widely different reconstructions of what really happened, Frayn's pace reenacts three plausible versions, one after another. In my own study of why Germany did not achieve an atomic bomb in World War II, I have found ample documentation for the three different explanations and for variations of them, regrettably often based on the axes that historians and journalists want to grind. This, of course, does not mean that they're equally valid. Careful research can establish with a significant amount of confidence what did take place. Is Michael Frayn's accomplishment a unique event in contemporary theater, or might we see this play as proof that a well-crafted, intelligent drama that deals with science and scientists can be written and can win an audience? Perhaps some of you here will provide the answer.
Christopher, please. As a Canadian, I feel I should apologize for Canadian physicists like Slotin. But at the same time, gosh, that kind of flirting with plutonium makes one doubt the rationality of physics. as an arts person, I don't see the value of the experiment. But in any case, what I want to do is to expand on things that Sydney has said, and maybe just approach from a slightly different angle. I want to ask a series of questions. It strikes me that there are, with so many plays documented by Harry and by Kristen and others, there is, one might say, almost a genre of science plays or science in theater, to use the term that Carl Gerassi has formulated. Is it useful to think of such things as a separate genre? Is it useful to think of works as being a mixture of science and theatre or science and literature, which are different from works about other things? And if so, how do we define such an animal? Now, for Sydney, it's partly the correctness of the science. For my, that's one of the things that I understood you to say, and that's maybe something we need to also discuss. For my other co-panelist, Harry here, it seems to be a strict form of accuracy, factual accuracy, that's the key, and I suspect that authenticity is going to be one of the major issues. And I was interested, for example, that Alan names Einstein as Einstein, whereas Rebecca changes Burma's name to something else. And the reasons for that and the question of authenticity there makes me wonder. Gerassi is quite clear when he talks about drama. He wants real factual accuracy. One of the plays that he cites as being the key work for him in science and theatre is a French play, Les Palmes de M. Schütz. And he calls it his perfect science play because, quote, it deals with Marie and Pierre Curie's discovery of radium in a realistic stage replica of a laboratory. Now, how realistic is that? But this call for factuality, realism, is, I think, a crux because, by definition, almost any form of art is on some level a work of imagination, and as Alan was suggesting, imagination may come into science, but imagination is also a separate category from the kind of thought that goes into science. Turning back to Harry's list, one needs to ask what makes what counts as science? Harry's list, for those who haven't seen it, goes back a ways. It includes philosophers like Faust or Dr. Faustus. It includes doctors or medical officers of health like Dr. Stockman in Ibsen's An Enemy of the People. It includes psychologists. It includes Hampton's Talking Cure, which deals with Freud and Jung. It includes psychiatric patients, cancer patients, even aviators, right in a play called Flight. So do plays have to focus on what are commonly called hard sciences, you know, physics, chemistry, biology, or is medicine an allowable field for a science play? Or how wide do we want to stretch it? Or either way, is having a scientist as one of your characters enough? That's one of the criteria you mentioned. And does it have to be a real scientist? Proof has been raised. This is an imaginary mathematician with an imaginary theorem, all invented. In fact, it's the daughter's relationship to the father and her relationship to her sister that is the key to that play, not indeed, from my perspective, anything to do with mathematics. And we never learn anything about the mathematics in the play. So is that a science play? And yet it's been touted as a science play. So where are we drawing the lines? Does the scientific character then have to be modeled on a real-life scientist, like indeed Oppenheimer in and my translation would be the Oppenheimer Affair, but and then this is a conference about science, both in present day and in history. If one goes back to C.P. Snow, who's also been mentioned by one or two people in this conference, and certainly got mentioned in another science conference that some of us attended a little while ago, C.P. Snow distinguished between traditional physics and contemporary physics and said that the real problem was, and what created the divide between science and arts, was the advances in contemporary physics. Everyone could understand Newton, an apple falling on the head. You know, this is and so you can understand gravity. As soon as you get into the level of molecular physics, there's a divide. Art can no longer deal with science. So if we go back to history and go back to Galileo or Newton, everyone understands the science. Is this any longer a play or a work about science? Or is it simply a work about history? Because it's not exposing us to the scientific principles on which our world is based. Newton's view of the world as mechanical. It's been challenged. History. Does that mean that historical fact is a different kind of fact as well? So does the period have to be modern? But then how modern and how serious do we want to be? If you put Einstein together with Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio, does that count as science? As Terry Johnson does that in Insignificance, for example. Or if you're Steve Martin and you write a play about Einstein and Picasso.
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, God, yes.
And Elvis Presley.
Yes, oh, indeed, yeah. Okay. where are we going to draw the lines? I don't want to be judgmental about this. I don't want to prejudge your answers. But you know, there really is a question, and part of the question is, how pedagogical does a play have to be? Is it, in Chiras's terms, all science plays have to be fulfilling an effective pedagogical function? And I think that you would agree with that, perhaps, Sidney, even though...
In a very limited way.
And it would certainly rule out a play. Your pedagogical function would certainly rule out a play like, Alan Ayckbourn's Body Language. Do you know that one? Two girls arrive at a country house by helicopter. As they get out of the helicopter, their heads get chopped off by the blades. Luckily, in this house they're visiting is a surgeon who has just sort of perfected, you know, body transplant. How fortunate for them. Unfortunately, he sews the heads on the wrong bodies.
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Of course.
Yeah, right. No, that's not a science play. But how didactic do you want to be? Do you want to be like Halle Flanagan writing E equals MC squared, where you have a character who's a professor and a character who's an atom, and the professor explains the atom?
Oh, God, no.
Oh, no, God, oh, God, no. all right, go on. Another question. What about theme? Does a science play have to be about a scientific principle or about a scientific discovery, quite specifically? Or no? That's a real question. And how relevant does it have to be? And the, all of the German plays you mentioned, I have other questions about Brecht, but anyway. The German plays you mentioned together with Kippert's Cold Light, Zuckmayer's Cold Light, Kippert's Oppenheimer, all three plays are written right after the atomic bomb is first exploded. Is that kind of relevance necessary, or can we go back? Anyway, those are some of the questions that I would like to throw out as a basis for further discussion. Thank you.
I purposely asked to be last because I thought it's the easiest position to be in to react to everything. And what I want to do is I want to talk about a new genre, a new way of doing things, and I want to call it science as performance rather than science as a lecture or science as science or science and playwright and all. And what you find in here at the speakers panel is Harry Lustig is now physicist historian, and you now find that Sid Perkowitz is a physicist playwright. And so I want to call myself now physicist producer. Right? And there's no one, I may be the first one. Also, when I look around at the audience that we have 60 people, means that this field that we're trying to create now isn't a very large field. And one of the things that's really important in theater is reaching the public. And so it may be nice that we all know these esoteric plays, but Harry has put together with Shepard Barr a list of 70 plays, and I have them with me, or some of them with me if you want a copy of it. We also have it on the web. That there's an opportunity here for the community to really take the material here and then present it without it first worrying about what is a science play and what isn't a science play. I think it's important to begin getting things out there and then getting reactions. And I want to talk about a little bit just how I got into this discipline, having been a real physicist and taught by Harry at City College my quantum mechanics. So it goes way back, our relationship. It turns out that I was in charge of the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the physics community. They were 100 years old in 1899. They were founded in 1999. They had their birthday party. And they asked me in part to be in charge of that birthday party. And Harry, being the treasurer, gave me a lot of money, which is unusual for having a birthday party of that kind. And it was in Atlanta where we expected 5,000 physicists who normally come to a March meeting, but we combined a lot of our meetings. And we had the largest ever physics meeting ever, 11,500 physicists in one place at one time, and the city of Atlanta has not recovered, really. But we decided we would like to do things for the public, and what had been done for the public before was to sort of, at your conference, have some ideas about physics and different kinds of things, how it impacts your life. And we took the take that we were going to bring physics and bring it out into the community. So we did, for example, the physics of ballet with the Atlanta Ballet in the Fox Theater. We did the physics of fractals at the High Museum. We did the physics of Star Trek at midnight in a theater downtown with thousands of Trekkies coming. So it was a way of trying to reach out with the arts to the community in their community. When I came back to New York after that, the play Copenhagen was about to open in New York. And I had been working with the Ensemble Studio Theater, which got a beautiful grant from the Sloan Foundation, which is partly supporting this conference, to encourage plays on science and technology. And I was a reader for them. And I and the Ensemble Studio Theater, reached an agreement that if they could bring Michael Frayn to New York and get him to speak, and I was in this new building on 34th Street and 5th Avenue, the former B. Altman building, I would get historians and scientists. And sure enough, they were able to bring Michael Frayn. In fact, they brought Michael Frayn and Michael Blakemore. And we developed, with Harry Lustig helping me, a three-part series. One was the history related to Copenhagen, two, the science related to Copenhagen, and three, the theatrics related to Copenhagen. One was at 12 noon, one was at 3 o'clock, and one was at 7 o'clock, with a dinner sponsored by the Danish embassy, and we ate food like the 1940s and drank beer at that time. So it was a real event, and little did we know that a week before this event was to occur, Jim Glantz of the New York Times wrote an article about the fact that this play was about to open, and then mentioned that there was a symposium at the Graduate Center. and literally thousands of people wanted to come. And I think a new phenomenon got created in terms of how you can reach out to the public on a real topical issue, both with respect to history, science, and theater. And that venue and that concept is a real good concept to follow up. As a result of that, at the Graduate Center, we've now put on 45 events that you could call science as performance. And each year we put about 8 or 10. And I'm leaving something here, which is just we're doing a whole series of events related to the Miracle Year of Einstein, a celebration of the 100th anniversary of Albert Einstein's Miracle Year in 1905 when he did his 3 seminal papers. At the same time as presenting things, I began getting involved in really producing things. And in fact, Sid Perkowitz mentioned that Albert and Isadora, a little dance thing he wrote, really came about because the Isadora Duncan dance troupe met with me and said, "We have no money." And I said, "Well." And she said, "We try to go around and tell everybody we do this great dance and nobody's interested in paying us." So I said, "Well, Isadora Duncan was a revolutionary at the time of the turn of the century, so was Einstein. What if you combine science and art and try to sell that? A dance about Albert and Isadora." That sold. In other words, everyone was interested in that. It was now combining 2 things. And the interesting thing is, although the arts get a tremendous amount of press, the sciences get all the money. So the idea is to combine the two. We'll use their press and our money and get the science and the arts out there. And so we produced a piece of work which got produced. Sid did the writing for that. Another thing that we ended up producing is with Lauren Gunderson in the audience. We were having the 200th anniversary of Alexander von Humboldt's trip in South America and the fact that he met with Thomas Jefferson in the year 1804. And so Lauren Gunderson was asked to really consider, could you write a play about the meeting between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander von Humboldt? And she wrote a play called Wide World, which we were premiered at the Graduate Center, which is a play we should know more about, and I think it was very well received. The third thing I just want to mention is that I met with Alan Lightman many years ago with a Macedonian director named Slobodan Okovsky, who was interested in doing a play, a serious play about Einstein's dreams. And he was at that time producing a play, being director of the play, I think 12th Night at the American Repertory Theater at the Globe Theater at Harvard. And we had a very good conversation, and Alan is very, very generous. I think there must have been by now 15 different, I think it's on your website, all the different incarnations of Einstein's dreams. And so he agreed, let's try and do something. And we worked with Slobodan Okovsky. And then he went back to Macedonia and war broke out and we never heard from him again. He just completely disappeared. And I had then seen Fermat's Last Tango, which was a play at the York Theater in New York, which played. And it was done by a husband-wife team. And then we thought, I was working with someone, and we thought, well, maybe we can make a musical out of Einstein's dreams and approach Josh and Joanne. And they said, "We've been thinking about this our whole lives." You know, like I was like a founder. And in some ways, we commissioned them to write a play. And I have some of the music for it. And in fact, I'd like if we get a chance to play one song here, which is I'll Never Let You Go, which is the best song that they did, which deals with what was read this morning. And we're now in the process of producing this play. Now, it turns out that physics is easy compared to theater and theater production, I can tell you. Nope, they leave you alone. You can do what you want. When you get rejected, they tell you. Well, it's really just a whole other world, and in fact, it doesn't involve lawyers. And the theater world does. And so we've learned a little bit about that, and now a very complicated process came about that one. This play, Einstein's Dreams, is actually being produced, opening in Portugal, with Alan's help, in September, in Portuguese and in English. But a second version of Einstein's Dreams, also a musical, is likely to open at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia this very September, a completely different musical. I'm involved in the production of both, so it's very strange things happen. At any rate, what I want to get across here is that what if we began thinking about science as performance at every level, be it, and I'm really into the performing arts, dance, music, theater, and even some of the lectures that scientists give or some of the lectures that humanists give, and really make it not a lecture but a performance, maybe bring in a choreographer or something like that. I think if we really want to reach the public, this is a way to go about doing it. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for five very interesting and very concise and very information-packed papers. I see that we're almost out of time, but I'm sure we've got time for a few questions. So, yes. Wait a minute.
I'd like to make one comment about Slotkin. I have decades experience as a technician in science, everything from astronomy to plasma physics. And I'd like to say there's two things. One is familiarity breeds contempt. Mm-hmm. That's a human condition. The second one is that there's this optimism with regard to ignorance. In other words, if you have chemicals around you, you automatically assume that they won't hurt you. In plasma physics, when you're working with high vacuum systems, cleanliness is godliness, and we used to use all kinds of horrible solvents to clean stuff that went into these vacuum systems. And then I had a friend in the early 80s who died of cancer that was attributed to trichloroethylene. And I learned a very interesting thing at that time, that toxicity is a statistical thing that's determined. And the best known was asbestos, and it was done by an amateur scientist who correlated asbestos with lung disease and that it was made worse with cigarette smoking. And in early 1980, there was only 7 chemicals that you could say for sure were toxic to human beings, and there was a phone book full of suspected chemicals. So point is that Slotkin wasn't a tragedy, and he wasn't a damn fool. He was just human. And he'd been doing these experiments for so long that he thought he could get away with murder. And I think it was called tweaking the dragon's tail, was what they called it at Los Alamos.
Tickling the dragon's tail. Tickling the dragon's tail. Yes.
Tickling.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, well, one of the questions raised, of course, in that play is whether Slotin was a hero or was he a villain, which is a favorite topic for dramatists. And he was a hero. He sacrificed his life by throwing himself on the bomb so that the other 7 people could live. On the other hand, he certainly, as you say, he was a little arrogant about himself and what he was doing. The play, by the way, it was shown at Los Alamos, and evoked a very great deal of negative reaction from the scientists there.
Surprise.
Well, some of them had still worked on a bomb themselves, and sort of maligning science. On the other hand, the director, when confronted with this, said they just had no idea that anybody would object to this play in any way. So there's naivete on both sides there.
I can think of one play with an historical character before Galileo, Sidney Howard's Yellow Jack, about the discovery of the cure to yellow fever. I think predates Galileo at least 3 years. Okay. But here's my question, which I mean to be provocative. I wonder really if, and it was a good question about what is a science play, and I wonder if there can be such a thing for the following reasons. Plays, because they are performed by human beings, almost inevitably end up in dealing with relationships between human beings and sometimes between human beings and society, collective human beings. Galileo isn't really about astronomy, it's about a relationship between an individual and power, or the struggle between new ideas fighting orthodoxy. I would say that even Copenhagen, for all the fascinating information it provides, is not really about science. It's about the unknowability of what happened in the past, of what truth is, maybe, how observation, the act of observing, alters what is observed. And so I wonder if you or anyone here would like to contradict my provocative assertion that there really can't be a play about science. It can use science to something else.
You heard that some of us were at a previous conference about science theater. This was last September in Wales. And quite a few people here, including playwrights, said, I just write plays. If science comes in, that's incidental. There is no such thing as a genre of science play. I think it's a very acceptable position, but I think for a person with scientific training who'd like to get in that direction, or a playwright who for whatever reason thinks, well, quantum mechanics would work here, it's okay to say, you are working in a little bit of a specialized direction. What do you need to do to make it be as bright as you need it to be? So at least in that sense, let's say there's something going on which deserves a little extra attention. A little bit of expertise may need to be there. I wouldn't push it further than that. If people want to say there's no such thing as a special science play, that's okay with me.
If I could just leap in a bit here. It strikes me that one of the interesting things is that people who are authors are identifying themselves as scientists who are authors, not just authors. And there are all sorts of other professions who turn to writing, but they don't say, well, actually, I'm a professor and an author. They rather disguise the fact that they're a professor, right? Whereas scientists say, I'm a scientist and I'm an author. And if you're someone like Carl Gerassi, you write a play called Ego. So, sorry.
Was that an autobiography?
There's a reason for that.
Yes.
Physical scientists are quantitatively trained, and they're kind of amazed that they can string three words together. So we got quite proud of that.
I agree that one cannot define a science play. I mean, that I agree with. And the 80 or 100 plays we put together, many of them I don't like at all. For example, I think they're bad, very bad plays. But science plays, but somebody says it's a science play, it's a science play. I don't agree with you that Brecht and Galileo and Copenhagen are not about science. Galileo is maybe not about science, but the work of science, the relationship of science, what scientists do, what they have a right to do, what they don't have a right to do. So science is absolutely essential. That we wouldn't make that assertion about a novelist, yeah, what he has a right to do. So. And Copenhagen is unabashedly about science. There's no question about that. It happens to be a gripping play at the same time. If we get a chance later, I'll demonstrate in that sense a good science play against the bad science play with some of the dialogue. But Copenhagen really is about science and real scientists.
I just wanted to bring this from another point of view, which is the audience. You know, why, perhaps this could help, why do people go to the theater? You know, do they go to the theater to learn about science, or do they go to the theater to learn about themselves? And I think that if, you know, somebody writes a play in which the person learns about, you know, him or herself through the characters, and then perhaps a little bit about the science, that's wonderful. But I think that the main purpose, and I'm speaking as a physicist here that also writes, but is to really for the person to learn about themselves, you know. And I would say the same about novels, you know, that there's no such thing as the science novel. You know, if you incorporate science into a novel, you know, that's great, but people are not going to buy, with very few exceptions, scientists and science buffs, they're not going to buy that book because he's going to learn about quantum mechanics.
There are 11,000 scientists we hear who all meet together on occasion. Critical mass. I mean, any publisher would love to sell 11,000 copies of a book.
I think Michael Frayn was kind of surprised that his play lasted 10 months on Broadway. And in fact, we just had Michael Frayn and Mike Blakemore over at the Graduate Center talking about the play Democracy. And what they find is that there is a certain intellectual audience that exists, very small in America, much bigger in Europe. And they call it a three-month run. You know, and after you run out of the intellectuals, it's over. So we wanted to know, like, what happened, and there's a lot of speculation. And one of the things that I speculate is that the topic of Copenhagen was such a important topic. Important in the sense that when they had asked, it was right about the turn of the century, and they had asked journalists, what were the most important events, journalistic events, of the 20th century? And the number one event decided by journalists was the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. And so this play had a tremendous amount to do with all those issues of the most important events, and it appealed to a lot more people.
I fear that we're at a point where
have to finish our discussion, but I'd like to thank the five panelists very warmly for a wonderful presentation. Sorry about that. Cut me off.